Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. This is Dan Turchin, host of AI and the Future of Work, CEO of Insight Finder, the system of intelligence for IT operations, and executive chairman of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. And we've met some real pioneers in the venture capital community in prior episodes. Guests like the great Bill Davidow took us back to the 80s and the founding of the most iconic venture firms. Others like Dave Kellogg shared what it was like to be a venture-backed exec at places like Business Objects in the 80s and 90s when, well, let's just say dollars weren't flowing quite like they are today. Today, we get a different perspective. We're going to open a different kind of time capsule. Rory O'Driscoll has been at Scale Venture Partners an incredible 27 years, during which he and his team have invested in some transcending companies, companies like Omniture, Box, DocuSign, HubSpot, Bill.com, and JFrog, really just to name a few. Rory's learned a few things over the years, and he's never shy about sharing his opinions. Rory's as passionate about politics as he is about AI, and frankly, he's done more thinking than you about the future of software. You know, truthfully, I don't know what we're going to discuss today, but I'm excited to get started. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to welcome to the podcast Rory O'Driscoll. Rory, welcome. Why don't you go ahead and describe your background and maybe how you got into venture capital?
Sure, Dan, and welcome too. And I don't think I'm quite that good, but I'll take it. So, I'm Irish originally. I went to college in the UK. I had set up a business in the UK, a startup after I graduated college. And I had the authentic, statistically likely startup experience, which is to say it went bust after 4 years. So I was pretty much effectively broke. It was the early 90s. I was lucky enough to be able to qualify for a green card because my father was an American citizen. And I emigrated to the States in December 24, 1991 with no money. So that was quite a time ago. I had the usual immigrant awful first job story, which we can skip. And then, met someone who was actually working in a large American bank, got a job with them. They ended up taking over the venture capital unit of that bank. I went down with them, started working there, and I've been in venture capital ever since, as you say, 1994, which is now a stunning 27 years ago. So I've been doing venture for the last 27 years. So I always tell people there's not much useful in the how I got there story. It's not really something I would recommend replicating, moving between countries, going bust, emigrating. It's all too random. I think actually the more interesting thing about venture that I often remind people is, quite how bad I was at it at the start. It's a really hard business to get right. And I do remember, it's an apprenticeship business. It's a long-term business. And I remember, 3, 4, 5 years where I thought I just won't survive in this business. I just don't know what I'm doing. I feel like a train wreck. And just how long it takes to get good at any business that has a 7 to 8 year feedback at best. And then on top of that, you overlay a business cycle, which can either accelerate the feedback and make you look smart, accelerate the feedback and make you look dumb. By the time you've normalized all this stuff, decades can have gone by. So it's a quirky business, but I love it.
You're the first venture partner I've interviewed who led out in your bio with a note about how bad you were at venture investing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's a humbling business and I never forget it. And, funny enough, even now, you sometimes you just do dumb things. You look back and you even 6 months later, what was I thinking? How did I profit? I always love the soccer quote, soccer man, you're only as good as your last game. And it's true in venture too. Every time you take the eye off the ball, you get sloppy, you start thinking you're always right. You make a mistake, you screw up and you know pretty quickly, right? So I like to remind myself of how, and also, talking to other people, you're never as good as you seem to be at the height of a bull market. But conversely, you're never as dumb as you feel you are when you've just lost money. It's a swings and roundabout business and you just got to stick at it, try and learn from the experiences and just incrementally get better. As I said, the great thing is it's a wonderful job. I'm so glad I have it. But I just love. And one of the ways to keep it is to always remind yourself how precariously hard it is. In the end, I always say to people, everything about this job is awesome. Freedom, the interest, the money, let's be honest, right? There's only one thing, you got to be right. And you got to be right, more often than you're wrong. And over time, that's the bar that you have to pass. So being very humble about how hard that is, in my view, the first step towards actually getting it right.
Well, I describe entrepreneurship similarly. It's a very humbling, field to be in. And the days when you feel like you're about 2 inches high are some of the best days in retrospect. And as long as you don't make the same mistakes over again, it's inevitable that you're going to screw up plenty of times.
Totally. And it's a lot harder than venture, I always say to people. It's a lot harder than venture. I mean, venture is different because there's less of an ability to hustle or work your way out of it. So there's more of an onus on being a little more cold-bloodedly right or wrong. It's more a decision business and less an action business. But in terms of raw effort and drive that it takes to make something happen, you know, entrepreneur is 10x harder than venture on that dimension. So,
Now, of the short list of tombstones that I listed in the intro, companies you've invested in, they were all B2B software companies. Curious to get your perspective. What does enterprise software look like in 2030?
Enterprise software, let me see, I'm just checking 10 years from now. So I'm mentally subtracting 10 years to remind you how much, you know, like what's that? Because I've, as I say, been in it since the early 90s when it was client server. I remember seeing my first business card from someone from Mosaic, which went on to become Netscape and invent the browser. So I can remember being in the software business before there was an internet, effectively. But I think the big thing in the next 10 years, which is really what we're talking about, is the following. So for the for the last 20 years, it became inconceivable to build software that wasn't built primarily for and starting in the cloud. That has been a statement of fact. I think in the next 10 years, it'll be equally inconceivable to build software that doesn't either incorporate AI, incorporate intelligence, or at least have some way of interacting with intelligence and leveraging intelligence to work more efficiently for the user. And I think that's the kind of big picture stepping back. Everything will still be on cloud. Everything, you know, I think enterprise software will still be, you know, at that stage, universally SaaS and cloud. But that will be a continuation of the trend that, you know, we're now probably halfway through. But I think the big thing is on top of that, anything new will incorporate intelligence. That's probably the biggest thing.
Can't talk about AI and software without addressing the issue of job creation versus job elimination. Is AI out to take your job or is it going to create jobs?
What's the word? Anthropomorphism, when you actually imbue things. That's a very ironic statement. You can't ironically imbue AI with intent, which could devolve to a whole metaphysical discussion that I'm not going to have about AI and intent. But fundamentally, AI is not about to do anything. People are about to do things, right? And people are going to use, so the question really is, what is the impact of AI in terms of jobs? I think it's going to be real. First of all, I think like any new productive innovation, there will be job displacement, right? And I think that that's an inevitability. I think in some cases, you know, it's the classic analysis of, you know, technology can be a substitute or a complement. And if it's a substitute, you know, the labor gets reduced. And if it's a complement, the labor value gets enhanced. And frankly, wages go up, right? And I think you can see both types of outcome depending on the technology. Because one of the big ahas we've had about AI, and it's obviously, it's very case specific. It's very fact specific. It's not a single universal trend like, you know, SaaS and cloud, where literally it was incredibly obvious that everything would move to the cloud in one fell swoop. Instead, the amount of intelligence you can add, the amount of work you can replace, is very facts and circumstance specific. In some cases, you can replace a lot. In some cases, almost none, right? But I do believe, obviously, that the whole point of AI, the whole point of automation, is to make better decisions, but also more cost-efficient decisions. So there is a work replacement implication in it. The reason I'm sanguine about it is, you know, the two levels. One, kind of at the, you know, macro level, is, you know, it's everybody, I mean, it's like soccer, everybody's got to play their position, right? As an investor, my position is to invest in things that have, you know, a positive return, right? The societal objective is to make sure that we have a society where everyone's taken care of and, you know, we have a set of policies such that folks aren't you know, horrible losers from the adoption of new technology. You know, the reason the Luddites were angry was they were losing their jobs and they were going to starve. You know, you sometimes maybe you probably couldn't. I mean, I don't think we'd avoid having textiles to protect hand spinners, but I think at the other hand, you should have, you know, institutions that would make that a lot less abrupt transition. But that's a wider comment. I think that the far more practical and important comment is this, and I always say it, is people's belief that AI is going to, quote unquote, replace workers is inversely proportional to how close they are to actually trying to sell AI. It's actually darn hard to replace people. They're pretty darn good. Right? What you discover, we have lots of companies incorporating AI into what they're doing. And what you discover is, you know, you can use this technology, it can make a difference, but it's extraordinarily hard to replace people. They're versatile, they're smart, they are very multi-purpose. AI is far less flexible. So I actually believe that you're not going to have this massive, you know, dystopian 5-year period when everyone's job gets replaced. It's going to be a steady grind of, you know, 2% productivity growth per year, best case, where, you know, AI gradually encroaches over time, but it's not going to be an all or nothing thing with vast amounts of unemployment as a result, because it's just simply hard. I mean, it's, you know, we do a lot in robotics, we do a lot in kind of AI within kind of knowledge worker systems. And it's always amazing the amount of implicit knowledge and implicit abilities that humans have. I mean, it's a cliche of, you know, robots find it, you know, easy to do things that we find hard, but also hard to do things we find incredibly easy. So easy, it's almost hard to describe what they do. So I don't think it's going to be a catastrophic change. I think it's going to be a gradual change. And, you know, gradual improvements in productivity are awesome for everybody. Because over time, it just, you know, makes the pie bigger. I acknowledge the issue. I don't worry about it too much in my daily toilism.
So many parallels with Luddism.
Yes.
I think throughout history, we've seen the story repeat itself that you never want to be on the wrong side of technological progress. Better to embrace it.
Yes, broadly speaking, far better to embrace it than to go against it. Right. But at the same time, keeping a weather eye on, you know, the consequences of it. I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, and this is a little digression from AI, but it's like I look back on, you know, free trade and the WTO, and I would have been, oh my God, of course, I'm an economics major. Of course, free trade makes sense. Yay, go us. But I think we did underestimate some of the costs of that. And I think you have to lean into the free trade, but also lean into to making sure that it's not too abrupt, that it's not too impactful, and that you do have to bear attention to the consequences to it, and, you know, maybe resolve it with other means. And I think we look back in the last 20 years, and I think a lot of the issues we've seen in the last recent period are because prior to that, you know, we all went yay free trade and didn't focus on all the consequences. I think the same thing can be true here. It's going to happen. You shouldn't be against it, but you do have to keep a weather eye on consequences.
You got a lot of entrepreneurs listening who are thinking about the right way to incorporate AI into their product, their business model. Talk to us about kind of failure modes and success modes when it comes to going to market with AI.
Open-ended question. So I think that there's a lot here, and it's all very nascent at this stage because, you know, we can talk about it in a second, but yeah, AI adoption in the enterprise is still fairly new, right? So the first thing I'll say is this. In the end, after you've done with the AI onboarding, it's still a business. It's still selling software. You've still got all the things that matter for every software business. You know, you've got the market, you've got the, you know, you go to market execution, you've got, you know, building a team, ideal customer, all that stuff, right? So the real question is, what's different on top? I think the first thing is that, you know, AI is interesting because it's probabilistic. And what it frequently means is that it's another way of saying sometimes it's right and sometimes it's wrong. And I think enterprises really struggle with that as a buyer, right? And if you're not careful, and we see one failure mode we see with early AI startups is you get, you know, these proof of concepts are great and they do really well. And then you get locked into never getting rollout because people can't get their heads around, how do I think about this is right this percentage of time and not that? You know, you get into arguments about the alternative, because people say, well, Mike, you know, people don't really know their own cost structures. Enterprises really struggle with their own cost structures. So they'll say, you know, it's, you know, we can, you get into the, we can do this more efficient, this automation isn't worth doing. You get locked into a whole bunch of, you know, rat holes like that. So I think really understanding and being able to articulate and being able to measure the hard ROI, including understanding, you know, what the failure mode is when the AI is wrong and how to fix that, is vital, right? So you have to understand the customer's economics. You got to get them to buy into that. And, you know, you've got to tweak some, it's got to be some combination of how you build the product and then how the customer manages the product such that failures can be handled, right? And by how I build the product, you mean, you know, if you have a recommendation engine to say sales reps on, you know, how to do things, if that gives you three dumb recommendations, they're going to turn it off. So you've really got to watch that you don't become the, you know, Mr. Clippy was way more annoying, and there's a lot more Mr. Clippy out there than people realize, right? And if the recommendations are wrong and you use confidence, there you're done. Another totally different kind of issue is, to the extent that you're kind of just processing paper, lack of a word. You know, if you're kind of just managing ingestion of documents and document capture, just having a process to, you know, review anything with a confidence level below X and smoothly handle it and retrain the model such that you continue to get better and better. I think that's another key part of it, right? Yeah, some of the best businesses we've found are, you know, where you leverage the AI, but to the business customer, it's not about the AI. It's like, the problem is, if you're selling software to the customer, you do get locked more into what does the AI do and how does it replace. And let me get into the weeds of this, because I, the customer, need to know, because I'm responsible. If, on the other hand, you're merely selling a good result, or if you're selling something that you're doing better because of the AI, but that to the customer they don't care, then it's just a lot smoother. And we have a number of companies, like I would say Forter is an example of that in our portfolio, where they're basically handling credit card fraud for merchants, because merchants, as you know, an online merchant with card not present, if there's fraud, they get dinged for it. So they don't like that, right? But on the other hand, they like to sell stuff online. So what Forter does is it leverages a huge amount of AI. But the customer doesn't care, because what the customer is buying is fundamentally, we will tell you with far more precision than the old on-prem software, which of your potential customers are fraudulent and which of the customers that you might trigger as fraudulent are in fact good. So the only thing you're selling the customer is more revenue, less expense. And that obviates that whole question of, instead of getting down in the weeds on, you know, how the software works, you're selling an answer. And it's also interesting because, back to that comment on, there are areas of a customer's business where they don't really understand their cost structure, but there are also areas where they understand it really clearly. And these kind of e-commerce related lifts or e-commerce related fraud costs are highly quantifiable. And in areas like that, it's very easy to just, you know, you end up in that lovely position where you have the better solution, you have the better mousetrap, and the buyer simply buys on rating the mousetraps in a quantitative fashion. So you win, right? We have a number of those kind of companies, and we think it's an attractive space, kind of an attractive trend.
I love that example of Forter. I had an opportunity to get to know Michael from Forter. And, you know, one of the things I think is underappreciated is that as vendors, we're educating enterprise buyers about how to buy AI-first products. And oftentimes, the comparison with all of the mistakes that humans make before AI is augmenting their decisions isn't appreciated. So the notion of a false positive, or even sometimes the false negative that AI might be vulnerable to, is often not compared to the number of incorrect decisions that we've made historically without AI. So it's generally always a net positive. I think there's that irony.
It is hard to get, like, if your pitch is, you know, you Mr. Customer, make a mistake, and we make less mistakes. Intellectually, you're correct, but you're right. It's just a very, you know, it's just a hard interpersonal thing to go down. So if you can abstract to that, to good results, it's better. No, you're exactly right. I mean, you know, the ultimate example is, you know, self-driving cars, and you get into the, yay, they almost certainly make less mistakes than we are, but we're clearly just resistant to the idea that those mistakes, our mistakes are mistakes of people, and we know what people are, so we forgive them. Their mistakes are mistakes of computer code, so goddammit, it's not acceptable. Right? And I think that's a magnified version of what you even see in these kind of situations.
Well, so let's play out that scenario. So let's say, you know, 5-10 years and AI is ubiquitous in the workplace. What is, given that that's likely to happen, what might cause the next, we call it, you know, casually an AI winter? We're probably right now in an AI summer. We've been in an AI winter. What might cause it to come back, given that the technology is going to continue to proliferate?
I don't know. I mean, I've been thinking about this because you're right. There's been two or three massive false dawns of AI over the last 40 or 50 years. And I'm sure, you know, what terrifies me, I'm sure at the height of those, you know, summers, for lack of a better word, all the participants in that were equally certain that this thing's going to go forever and it's all going to work. And you play the tape back and it didn't. So when I start saying to myself, yeah, but this time it's different and it's all going to work, you know, I have enough dark issue from being an investor. Whenever you say this time it's different, you got to pause and say, it's almost, is it really? Why would it be different? So, the question makes me pause and think in a kind of paranoid, what am I missing fashion, right? I do believe it is, and then I say it, and I smirk when I say it, I do believe this time it is somewhat different, and with apologies to myself. I think that a lot of the, you know, the case-based reasoning and the, you know, decision systems were very brittle, and tried to do a lot and proved hard to maintain, especially in kind of enterprise silos. I think the advent, I mean, obviously everyone always says the advent, the internet not only gives you lots of data, you know, massive compute essentially available, but also I think an underestimated thing, an ability to manage the AI and evolve it over time centrally, rather than having all this deployed software on individual customer places where over time, I think it degenerates, right? I think that one of the things that would cause, you know, pullback here is if the gains promised by AI were illusionary or weren't being realized and the improvements weren't happening, right? So I think the structural advantages, the basic architectural advantages of having, you know, cloud-based vendor building central models that they can continually evolve and, you know, automatically because it's, you know, SaaS or cloud software, it rolls out to all the customers individually, is a huge, it takes this thing from a series of discrete lifts to a continuous improvement process. And I think that's just a huge thing, right? I think, you know, yeah. I think that probably will be very one of the biggest factors in ensuring that, you know, the areas where it's rolled out will continue to get better. And we see that. I mean, I think you see it, you know, I think, yeah, consumer AI adoption, you know, predates enterprise AI adoption by 5 to 10 years, which is, I think, another phenomenon of the internet. It was not true at all pre the internet. In the 70s, you know, you had these knowledge-based systems being rolled out in the enterprise, and it just simply wasn't relevant in the consumer world, right? Totally different in the post-internet adoption of AI. You know, Google and Netflix have been figuring out AI on all of us as individuals for the last 10 years, and I think maybe 20 in the case of Google, and I think it's precisely because of something I said earlier, it's a probabilistic technology. Yeah, the Netflix recommendation engine is very forgiving of minor failures. You know, if they recommend me a modestly good movie, life goes on, right? So they've been able to deploy that, but at the same time, there is significant lift, right? They've been able to deploy that, you know, as I say, using the centralized architecture, continually grind at those recommendation engines, continually get them better. And now I think it is a source of competitive advantage, because if you think about, I mean, Netflix, they have this wonderful thing now, they generate content where they can generate content, predict who will buy it, and then push it to those people. It's just awesome. It's a closed loop system. And none of that would have been possible in any kind of architecture that wasn't, you know, central network based. I think we'll see the same thing in the enterprise as it comes later to the AI party, right? I mean, you cited Fortran. You know, Fortran, I think Sokio are both examples in our portfolio of companies that are providing essential services. Fortran's case, credit card fraud prevention, in SoCure's case, online identity verification, where they provide essential service to B2B customers, the merchants or banks or financial institutions, where it's already working. It can continue to get better over time. So I don't think you'll wake up one day and suddenly realize the stuff doesn't work anymore, right? So I don't think you'll have that same kind of abrupt, you know, AI winter where everyone goes, what were we thinking? We bought this stuff and it doesn't even deploy, right? But back to the comment on it's all very facts and circumstance based. I do think there will be a lot of failures in AI. Absolutely. Because it, precisely because every task is, the ability to automate different tasks, it turns out to be very different and very, I won't say very unintuitive, but somewhat unintuitive, right? It's not clear in advance. I mean, it's the quote, you know, hard things are easy and easy things are hard, right? What actually is successful and not will vary, you know, up and down, yeah, opportunity by opportunity, right? I think that, self-driving is obviously one of the most obvious, you know, where people underestimate what it would take. And you know, there's a definite, you know, mile, I won't call it an AI self-driving winter, but definitely a kind of a year or two of loss of faith. And then now appears to be some emerging hope that still TBD, right? But I think that would be the case across the board. I mean, I think that, you know, we're looking a lot at, you know, kind of the role of AI in medicine. And again, it's very much facts and circumstances to pay, both based on, you know, what is actually technically doable, and then what fits easily into the system that it finds itself in, right? And both of those things have an impact on, you know, adoption. So I think there will be a, rather than a, quote, AI winter, I think there'll be a series of stop-start adoptions as people painfully learn where it works and where it doesn't. And I think even for us as investors, one of the big ahas we had about, you know, I think 6 to 7 years ago, we started seeing more AI in the portfolio, is that it's a lot harder, technically, to say the banal, than just very basic SaaS or infrastructure software, which is fairly deterministic. And it's not trivial, but in general, most SaaS companies that I've been involved with, you know, the software got made. I mean, it might be pretty, it might be able to run a little faster, but it got made, right? Whereas in the AI space, you have a lot of, oh, it gets it 85% right, and it turns out the customer needs 95% and you just have to work. Right. So I think there will be a lot more failure modes in the part of SaaS, in the part of software that's AI centric than there has been, for example, in the SaaS. Or maybe failure modes for different reasons. It'll be literally the tech didn't quite work. Again, it's not an AI winter, but it is a, we thought that problem was doable. It's not. I mean, for example, we've looked at NLP, super interesting, a lot going on. We've looked a lot at AI for what I think of as high English comprehension knowledge worker markets, lack of a better word. I mean, simplistically, we say, what happens when computers can, quote, speak and understand, can read and understand English? And I put the metaphorical quotation marks in there, because of course, again, avoiding the threat of what does understanding mean, right? You know, there are, you know, jobs like legal, a large part of their job is, you know, the ingestion and assimilation of huge amounts of written material and summarizing and abstracting it. And, you know, we've looked a lot at what computers, you know, AI can and cannot do. And for many of the important stuff we found, it's that classic. It's almost good enough, but almost good enough just isn't good enough, right? And we've seen for things like summarizing case law, right? It turns out computers can get remarkably close, but no one's going to buy it because you need to have it exactly right. So that's an example of where you thought, oh, AI could really make a difference here, but it turns out not quite yet. Right? So I think there's a myriad of that all across the board.
So there's some easy cases like Netflix recommendations or Amazon recommendations where I think most of us are willing to accept that, you know, a decision that's augmented by machines, stakes are pretty low, you know, generally net positive. What about when we turn to things like, you know, the impact of, you know, like the example you gave, a self-driving car making a bad decision, or, you know, an underrepresented minority inadvertently getting turned down for a loan, or, you know, AI making decisions about who goes to prison. Just take it up a level. As a society, what's our state of readiness for, incorporating AI-aided decisions into, you know, processes where the stakes are high?
I think, you know, hopefully I know a little about AI and investing, but that does not give me any kind of meaningful mandate to speak for quote unquote society. I'm, again, back to the soccer now. I believe everyone's got to play their position. My job is to invest in good AI companies. The job of governments, the job of, you know, the extended government judiciary and all that is to wrestle with these issues and make rules on behalf of society. I hope I can do my job well. I also hope they can do their job well. And that's their job. I think that two comments. The first is, you know, from a distance, whenever you see a congressional hearing on anything to do with technology, nothing they say or do makes you feel they understand what's going on here, right? And that's worrying, right? Because it's hard to regulate well things you don't understand, right? I just listen, I go, that's not quite how I think it works, but whatever, right? I do think one role you do have on, as it were, the technology innovator side of the table is just being very clear about what the technology can and can't do and directly forthright about that, right? And just, you know, I think explainability of AI is a huge thing, right? I think obfuscating, you know, the issues, it does no one any good. Equally overclaiming the issues does no one any good. So I think that our role is, you know, at a minimum role is to just be very clear about what the stuff can and cannot do, to understand, as I said, those kind of issues where you have real societal impacts. Is that I think where it gets so the stuff is imposing, because what I'm basically saying is I am looking to it shouldn't be for us to decide. I mean, the idea, like, and it's kind of interesting at the moment, so much of this is being punted on by the people who actually have the authority to pass laws under my reading of the US Constitution, which, right. You know, it's a pity it's been punted back on tech companies, a lot of this stuff. So one would hope that these kind of issues could be addressed by the competent governing bodies, right? And that our role in that would be to say, for example, is to say, like, AI facial recognition errors, the massive variances by ethnic origin are just, wow, that's concerning. And if you give these tools to people and you say to them, this is awesome, it gets it right every time, you're like arming people with something that's going to blow up in their face and hurt innocent third parties, right? And so that's, yeah, our role in that has to be not do that kind of hyperbole. And the role of the, especially government entities using AI, has to really understand what they're dealing with and be very open about that. And it's hard because whatever it is, polarization, or is it just non-understanding of technology, you often listen and go, wow, I don't think you're quite getting what this thing can do. That was a bit of a rambly answer. You know, I'm not sure I have, I wouldn't set myself up as an authority on this subject.
I think that there's a need for AI to be scorecarded, like you give a restaurant, you know, a cleanliness or kind of a hygiene score. I think there's a need to measure AI based on, you know, is it transparent? Is it predictable? Is it configurable? And to me, that screams for a need for some kind of regulatory frameworks. But here we're just on the precipice of coming out of a pandemic when we can't even ask citizens to wear face masks without, you know, encountering some political firestorm. How in the world are we? I'm trying to take the bullish case here, but I get a little bearish when I think about our willingness to accept a regulatory framework that governs how AI is used.
Yeah. Again, I think that the good news, at least, is it's less time critical. I mean, you know, definitely the last year you look back and you go, yeah, turns out when a lot of scientific decisions have to be made in very short order on things that impact everyone, then, you know, a lot of times, you know, we don't get it entirely right, to say the least, and it gets quite polarized on many times. Worth pointing out, however, at the risk of going rah-rah for venture, albeit the healthcare side where I don't invest. Yeah. The one thing that worked perfectly well in this entire last year has been, you know, big pharma, who spent the last 20 years being vilified by everyone on either side of the aisle, and, you know, promptly delivers the vaccine that gets everyone out of, you know, the get out of jail free card. So, you know, rah-rah for science, rah-rah for venture, you know, rah-rah for people doing their job and doing it really well. You know, I don't invest in biotech, but you just have to be stunned by that achievement. So that's been the home run win here. And you're right. Yeah. The truth is, politics is a lot messier and more complex than science and even business, which is why I'm glad I'm in the, you know, the science and business space. I think the art of politics is less clear, less satisfactory, and harder to do. And, you know, one of the reasons I'm being so circumspect is I'm always wary of the folks in Silicon Valley as we opine on, you know, what quote unquote the government or the populace should do. I think, you know, I'm humble about how hard my job is. I'm even more humble about how hard it is to be, you know, an elected representative of our great democracy and, you know, dealing with the myriad of different competing interests you have.
Now, roll back the clock. In October of 2019, you published a great blog post and you proposed kind of three strategies for startups. This was kind of talking more about SaaS and cloud adoption, sure. But you talked about either fight, you focus, or you fly. Maybe if you could apply that to what's going on now in terms of, you know, add AI to that mix of other technologies that we're talking about then.
Sure, I think it actually was in the technology, because the point I was trying to make there was exactly this point, which is, you know, the fight, focus, fly is that when you look at cloud and SaaS adoption, you know, the optimist says, you know, we're only somewhere between 35 and 50% of the software. About 50% of the current software spend is cloud, about 35% of all workloads are on the cloud infrastructure. So, hey, we're less than halfway there. On the other hand, at current growth rates of 30%, you're going to be fully there in 4 years. So the point I was making is, you know, the cloud, and that's the nature of exponential growth that people always underestimate. The last 4 years happened really quickly. So the point I was making is, if you look at it from the point of view of someone doing a startup today, right, you're living in a world where realistically, by the time you get to $100 million in ARR, the on-prem world is gone. It's all SaaS and cloud, right? And therefore, you have three strategies, right? And the first is, you know, go toe-to-toe and replace. Totally doable. I mean, Eric Yuan and Zoom did it. They just took out WebEx and said, you're mediocre, we're good, we win. Thank you, here's our $100 billion. Right? Stunning achievement. Will it be doable across the board? We'll see. You know, will someone replace Salesforce in the next 10 years? Don't know. Will someone replace ServiceNow? Some of these guys are formidable competitors. I think there will be next generation venture-backed companies where the fundamental thesis is this X is already on the cloud, you're going to replace them. And that's what I mean by fun. In other words, take on a category and just replace the incumbent. The second kind of, you know, plea, which is flee to the parts of the market where there's still growth. I mean, when you step back and look at the software market, right, I actually think that, you know, cloud will be almost 100% of that software market in the next 4 or 5 years. But the interesting thing is, and Andreessen was right about this, software is eating the world, which means there are areas where software is most closely munching on enterprise spend in other areas. I think, you know, the obvious two examples are, you know, telco-related spend. There's a, you know, the software market is roughly $500 billion a year. The telco market is roughly, it's really worldwide, right? And software's eating into that. Every time, you know, a Zoom or a RingCentral where we're investors, or any Dialpad where I'm currently an investor, you know, effectively annexes spend from the telecom marketplace and puts it in the software space. That's an example of, you know, software eating real dollars. Because I, as you may have noticed, I tend to think in part like an economist is, you know, well, not just technical term, but where is the money, right? And there's a finite pool of software money. It'll probably grow, but pretty soon we're going to have to find other piles of money, right? And I think the nearest adjacent one is definitely that telco spend, which is why Twilio and all these guys are having great runs, because there's just way more growth there, for example, than I think in Salesforce as for CRM. I think the CRM marketplace is, you know, mid-teens grower and pretty saturated. Another example is, you know, banking services, which are entirely digital. That's another area where software is, you know, happily munching through at scale, right? And then the fly comment was do something like AI where you literally, you know, you're not engaged in trying to just be a better version of a SaaS or cloud product where you're trying to build on top of, right? And the idea is just take the cloud as a given, take SaaS as a given. If you fast forward 5 years and you assume every app is on every 90% of workloads are cloud-based and 90% of SaaS software is SaaS-based. What do you build on top of that? And it's a story, if you're dealing with sales reps, It's not a story of replacing Salesforce. It's a story of what combination of voice AI, recommendation AI, allows you as a sales rep to get levered in a way where your Salesforce remains your system of record. And will, you know, Salesforce will be embedded in every company in this land after you and I are both dead, right? Because no one moves that stuff out, right? But can you build on top of that and provide, you know, great AI-driven functionality that literally makes the job better? But that was my point. So you got to, you know, the classic Gretzky comment, who I think just passed away, is that, you know, you got to go where the puck is meant to be going, right? And, you know, if you're starting, I mean, I know you have done some work in this space. If you do a startup today, you've just got to assume that, you know, you got to look forward to a world where, you know, the trends of the last 5 years play out, and it's a cloud and SaaS world, and how do you fit into that?
Great framework. I learned a lot from reading the post, so it was good to have you unpack it. Rory, it seems like we're just getting started, but we got to get to a stopping point here. I think there's about 10 hours of topics we could unpack here. Maybe if you wouldn't mind, we'll have you back for another session and we'll continue some of this. This is fun.
Good.
But let me get in one last question. Sure. You've done so much, you've accomplished so much. What's your advice for a younger version, Rory?
Keep exercising in your mid-20s because you put on weight if you don't. It's the biggest one. I actually don't wake up and think I've accomplished much. I think, we've invested big, we've done a lot, but there's just so much. I think the great thing about this business is there's always so much more to do, and I think there's so many more. I mean, the good thing and the hard thing about Silicon Valley is you're surrounded by people who are so much more accomplished than you at all times. And you go, wow, that's a great deal. I wish I'd done that deal. Or, wow, they saw that trend before me. So I don't wake up and go, yay me. I wake up every morning and go, I'm really behind here. How do I figure this thing out? How do I understand these new markets? Oh my God, all this new stuff. I mean, I'm doing a Coursera course right now to try and understand, you know, what's going on in AI. Just so always be forward-looking would be the first thing. That's where I am. So I don't know. Unscripted advice to me 25 years ago is glad I came to the States. That worked out well. I suppose it is the cliche one, but I didn't do it, so I can give it. Is that, you know, I look back and it's definitely true within reason that a calibrated risk you take early on is the right thing to do, right? I think that because I had a business that did not work out early on, I took an early risk, it didn't work out, it sent me back quite a lot. So I was probably more risk averse in my late 20s and 30s than in retrospect I wish I was. And I think, I have to give it carefully. This is not the kind of unnuanced Silicon Valley, yay, always take risks kind of advice, because I think to some extent that's rubbish because it doesn't understand context. What I would say is this: put yourself in a position where you can take risks. And by putting yourself in a position, I mean, look, it's a combination of, you know, great college education, a useful skill, right? The truth is this: a computer programmer who moves to Silicon Valley works for a couple of years in Facebook, a talented comp sci degree, a couple of years at Facebook, who then, quote, takes a risk of doing a startup, isn't really taking a risk. They're 25. If it doesn't work out, they can go right back to their, you know, six-figure job. It's all fine. But why wasn't they smart? So what I say to people, and I'm actually trying to talk to high school kids a little now and kind of give career advice for better or worse, is very much this. Put yourself in a position where you can take risks and they're not fatal, and then take those. But the conjoined piece of advice. Don't just say, hey, take risks. Because I know what it's like to take risks when there is no safety net, and it's damn hard. It can set you back a lot. But put yourself in a position where you can take those risks and know that the downside is not fatal, and then take them and take them aggressively. But if you look at the success pattern, frankly, of almost every one of our great tech founders, brutally put, that's what they are. Middle to upper middle class folks with frankly somewhat privileged background in some cases, and in other cases, not as much a privileged background, but a great education, where you know in your mid-20s you can take that risk and you'll be okay. You might, you know, gamble some upside, but you're not going to go to the wall. You're not going to be, you know, on the street, right? And then roll that dice. That's the path to the biggest success, I think.
Well, there you have it. The hungry and humble Rory O'Driscoll. Thanks for joining us today. This was a lot of fun. And please come back sometime and we'll continue the conversation.
Take care, Dan. Enjoy.
All right. Bye. This is Dan Turchin signing off for today. Back next week with another fascinating guest.